Real life.
Superpowers.
You need to bring yourself to the table. You need to bring your personality. You need to bring your soul. You need to be connected to your teams, especially if you have a team. And in the other hand, you need to have the knowledge. Because if you don't have the knowledge, people know it immediately. And this is, you know, they don't believe you anymore.
Welcome to Real Life Superpowers. I'm Noa Eshet, co-hosting here with Ronen Manipaz. In this episode, we speak with someone who's truly climbed his way to the top, starting from humble beginnings and pushing forward with determination. Oshri Derry began his career just 14 years old, working as a dishwasher. From there, he transitioned into hospitality, moving from service roles to high-level management. Oshri's managed some of Israel's most prestigious hotels and then went on to spearhead Brown Hotel's expansion, particularly in Greece. Nowadays, he's a real estate entrepreneur, leading million-dollar deals across Israel and Greece.
Real life.
Superpowers. Superpowers.
Oshri, welcome to Real Life Superpowers.
Hi, nice to be here.
Oshri, you've been in hospitality how long?
Wow. Actually, from the age of 14, for my life, I think. I started as a dishwasher in a wedding hall when I was a kid. It was my goal in life to start doing something for myself, to work. Providing myself with everything that I wanted. And since then, I'm in the hospitality industry. Basically, after the army, I joined the real hospitality industry, the hotel industry in Eilat, in Israel. And I'm doing that for the last 24 years.
And what was the draw to hospitality specifically?
I think it was discovering the bright side of life. This was my point of view. It started when I was working in a restaurant in the north of Israel. I was born and raised in Tzfat. Tzfat is a northern city in Israel. And I worked over there in a very famous restaurant named Bat Yar. It's a restaurant in the middle of the forest. And I liked it so much. I liked to see how people, you know, are going to the small villages and then they go up to the restaurant when it's snowy and rainy and they enjoy themselves. And you feel like you touch people in the good part of their life. And that's how I got, you know, into this business.
I mean, it sounds like there's a background here. You know, you're talking about needing to provide for yourself. Did you struggle in that sense as a child?
No, no, it was not struggling, actually. You know, I'm coming from a very medium class family. Both of my parents was working for all their life in normal jobs, providing for the family. Nothing was, you know, the fridge was always full. We had everything that we wanted, but in the other end, I was looking more for the independency of having the ability to buy for myself whatever I want. It was not the life that we live now, you know, with Facebook and Instagram. You didn't know what other people are doing. You didn't know, you know, I was living in a very small city and a very small community. So I didn't know exactly how the other life looks like. But I knew from the beginning that I want something bigger and I want something brighter, let's say.
Okay, so you're 14 and you're going to wash as someone who washes dishes, okay?
Yeah.
You're going to school and I'm probably not the person saying, guys, look how cool I am. I'm washing dishes, right? So
back in the days, it was quite cool because, you know, my pocket was always full with money and it was not the status of all my friends. So I was buying to myself whatever I wanted, and I lived actually two lives: my life as a school student, and my life as the guy who works in this wedding hall. So I enjoyed it. I didn't look at myself like, you know, I'm washing dishes. I'm in a low kind of position. I was very proud of that, actually.
So at that point, you're actually in a wedding hall, okay? You're meeting people who are, you're getting married, which is like always a great context. Everybody's happy. And then you work in this restaurant where in the middle of the forest, people are having this cool experience. It's like a little bit of escapism. You're like looking, searching for like the happiness in people.
100%. This is something that everyone who knows me, will tell you that this is exactly my character. I will always look on the half glass that it's full. I will always look on the bright side. I will always look for good solutions, never fighting, always, trying to find the equal part with people. I think that this is exactly my character.
So on that optimism, okay, you're in hospitality, starting a lot, right? Yeah. Did you study anything?
Well, I studied in a very, very late stage, and I did it only for the fun. I studied in the age of 36. I went to study law because I met the law in so many ways in the hospitality industry. So I thought to myself, wow, I need to study the law. I have to study the law. I need to go deep inside to understand about contracts, how it goes, about a structure of companies, and all these kind of things. This is why. So I went to do it only for the fun of it. And you know what? I gained so much knowledge, and not only knowledge, I gained so much good friends because I went to law school with people, from many places in the country. And all of them were quite, my age, let's say. And I met some very, very good friends with key positions in military, police forces, very special people.
So out of all the things in hospitality, okay, so you're in hospitality, you're 21, you went, like, there's so many things. There's like management, there's HR, there's, business administration, there's accounting, there's financing, so that's what you decided. Because, okay, so where were the hurdles and challenges that you said, okay, listen, I can't be handicapped in law?
No, I will tell you, I will tell you, look, when you go to work in the hospitality industry, basically you get sucked in immediately. There's a huge shortage of manpower. And so you get sucked inside. There's a huge shortage of human resources. And I started working as a waiter. I started from the beginning all over again, because actually I had a lot of experience already since I was moving in this wedding hall. It's a good story to say that I was a dishwasher, but I was a dishwasher for a couple of months. Then immediately they discovered my character. I was funny. I was talking a lot. So they said, hey, man, you have to be a waiter. Come work with us, Go out to the floor. I went out. It was great. I had huge tips. I liked it a lot. You're just nice to people and they give you tips. And I enjoyed it. So they promoted me to be, there's kind of a shift leader, different terms in this industry. So I was kind of a shift leader. We had two wedding halls, one big and one small. I was in charge of the small one. And then they recruited me to the army. It was great. I did my 3 years like everyone. And then I had a dream to go to Eilat, to go to the factory of the hospitality industry in Israel. It started when a guy who worked with me went to Eilat and he came back to, share with us some stories about the city, about the vibe, about the tourism industry. And I was in shock. I said, wow, this is a huge opportunity for me because I see myself as a talent in that part of, providing services to people. And so I went immediately after the army. First of all, I crashed my mom's car. I did a big accident. And then I waited for half a year. And then I...
Why did you have to wait?
Because I crashed. And I was injured in my head. It was quite of an accident, yeah. Luckily for me, nothing serious happened, but eventually I went to Eilat and I started as a waiter, as a waiter in the dining room of the Le Meridian Hotel in Eilat. Didn't know quite, back then, I didn't know what is the, I didn't understood what was the structure of companies, because in one hand there's the owner of the asset, was the Offer Brothers, there was the management company that was Fatal Hotels, and then there was the Le Méridien Hotel, that it's an international chain. I didn't understood what is the connection between those three companies, only on a later stage. So I enjoyed it, of course. You know, the atmosphere in Eilat is you work, you party, throwing up every once in a while, you know, crazy life. But I enjoyed it, and it was fun. And since I came with a lot of knowledge, immediately they understood that I speak the language, and they promoted me to be a shift leader. And then I forgot to tell that during my military service, I studied bartending, because it was, you know, bartender is supposed to be a cool thing. You don't know that you polish glasses the whole day. but I did, and they understood that I can speak the language, and then they promoted me immediately to be a shift leader, and then from there to the bar, to the restaurant, and many other positions.
So there, you already became, at the end of that you know, position to position, you're placed as the CEO or the management of that hotel, or was it a different one?
No, it was a different one. I entered the hotel as a waiter, and after 7 years, I got out from the hotel as the assistant for the general manager, as number two. I was very, very proud of that. It was 7 years that I jumped from one position to the other in the food and beverage department. It was great. I learned so many things. And in Fatah Hotels, they used to invest a lot in the people. So
why you? Why were you promoted so high? Okay, usually like in these things, you know, you bring assets from other hotels to, you know, learn. Like usually, you know, when you bring high executives, it's the stepping stones, you know, why would they take you out of all these people? You haven't studied, you haven't, you know, managed anything before. Like, why you?
Consistency. I think this is the word. The fact that, you know, it's a very hard thing working in Eilat, working in the tourism industry, being a hotelier, serving people. You know, normally in Eilat you serve 90% of your clients are Israelis, so it's quite a difficult thing. You know, people have their expectations, they pay a lot, and they have very high expectations. So it's very hard, and I never broke. I think that this is one of the key things that I always knew, that first of all, it's not so bad. You know, you go, you feel the people, you try to enjoy everything that you do. You decide, actually. I have a very good story about it. When I was a food and beverage manager, it was the third year at this Le Méridien. Because as I told you, I started as a waiter, and then I got promoted, shift leader, then dining room manager, lobby manager, pool manager, and then assistant for the food and beverage manager. So all those positions took between a year to a season, something in this area. And then I got promoted to be the food and beverage manager. And this is a very hard thing. Actually, you are number three in the hotel. I was 25 years old. I was a kid, actually, thinking about it now. You know, I started my position. You are in control of around 100 people, kitchen team, food and beverage service team, dishwashing, hosts. So in charge of on a lot of money. So my first year, you know, I came very, very strong. I knew exactly what I wanted to do. I worked under three food and beverage managers, so I knew what to do and what not to do. I came with a lot of experience, and I did my first year. My first year was wonderful. Then the second year, you know, you fight with your own success. Now you compare yourself to yourself, and this is much more difficult than comparing yourself to someone else. So I tried to invent myself in everything that I was doing. This year was very, very hard. I was fighting my own goals, and but you know, it came equally like my first year. Then came the third year. The third year was a huge challenge. I actually broke under the pressure because, you know, it's my 3 years in this position. And I remember myself, I was driving a scooter back in the days. I remember myself driving to the hotel and I'm thinking to myself, man, I hate what I'm doing. I hate it. What's going on? Like every day is the same. Passover comes again, the holidays, summer, summer after summer, I'm doing the same stuff. And I remember it very clear. I remember exactly when it happened that I thought to myself, man, take control on things. You decide if you enjoy it or not. You decide if you take it as an upside, the fact that you know everything, that it's your third year and everything. It's your decision. And I made a lot of self-coaching to myself. And then I entered with a totally different approach. I was focusing 100%. I'm so happy that I did because it changed my life, actually. I changed my whole management philosophy. I was training people 16 hours a day. This is what I was doing as the food and beverage manager. I was training the bartenders and I was training the waiters and I was training and training and training people. And suddenly the magic happened. Suddenly you feel that you are so strong with the knowledge of your team. It was amazing. It was a huge success. It was the most successful year. And then immediately they promoted me to be the assistant for the general manager.
That is so impressive because it seems like at such a young age, you had this inner wisdom of understanding how much you're in control of how you feel and how you're thinking. And I'm also hearing that this was intuitive pretty much since forever, because it seems like, you know, the hospitality business requires a lot of resilience and there's a lot of ups and downs. And from a young age, you weren't afraid to pull up your sleeves and work, because it seems like you had that intuitive wisdom to look at the bright side and to choose how you feel. And that crisis that you're describing, I mean, it seems like it's so out of character in a sense, but then also it seems like exactly on character, because in a way it seems like you were able to exactly apply the toolkit that you have embedded inside you and rise above that crisis. So I'm really curious if you know where you got that wisdom from. Is this the type of house that you grew up in, or did you have any mentors, or is this purely just, you know, how you roll forever?
I have so many things to say about it, but nothing is accurate. Nothing is accurate. Once I read an article of Yair Lapid, I'm not his biggest fan, but it was a very nice article that he wrote about what is being intellectual. What is being an intellectual? So he was telling a story about a good friend of him that he's a rabbi. And he was sitting with his rabbi and he was asking the rabbi, tell me, rabbi, you know, what is being intellectual? What is it? So the rabbi told him, you know, I will tell you something. Once my grandkid came from school and I sat with him and I told him, tell me, what did you learn something new in school? He said, yes, of course. What did you learn? We learned today about the story of Joseph and the cotton of the striped cotton. He told him, wow, this is an amazing story. Basically one of the best stories in the Bible. So he told him, can you tell me the story? He told him, yeah. You know, Joseph was dreaming a dream and his brothers got mad at him and they threw him to a hole. And so what happened then? So then the class ended. So he's asking him, and you didn't read the rest of the story? He told him, no, I will wait for the next class. So he says, you know what? My grandson is not an intellectual. So basically being an intellectual is having this eager to learn. Okay, I remember myself from a very young age. This is something funny, you know, they laugh at me always, my brothers, that I was reading the encyclopedia, you know, all the books that everyone were buying back in the days and no one was using them. I was reading them. I was I would go for TV shows that they are not, that they are, you know, about researches, yeah, basically things that are a bit deeper. I'm not trying to picture myself as this huge character, smart, learning, blah, blah, blah. But basically, I'm very curious. And I was not a good student, to be honest.
What you're describing would actually typically pull you down, you know, because in a sense, the more you dig deep into things, there's more worries that you can accumulate and more scenarios that you can now envision. And yet your center is very strong. And you were describing it yourself. You were on that scooter and you were thinking to yourself, I am choosing this. I'm in control of what I'm feeling and thinking. So do you know how you were able to do that?
Some of the thoughts that I have in my head now is regarding the fact that, you know, you gain knowledge with the experience. So you learn how to tackle things, you know, how to react to things. And you see, you know, you work with many people in this industry. So you see sometimes that people are leaving for nothing and then they come back and they struggle to join again. It's like jumping on a speeding train. So I think that basically it's a combination of things.
We're excited to be collaborating with the Israeli website CTech, owned by Kalkalist, Israel's leading business newspaper. CTech is the gateway of the Israeli high tech to the tech world and vice versa. If you're not already a regular reader, we strongly recommend that you check out kalkalistech.com, CalkalistEch.com, to stay up to date on all high impact stories from the Israeli tech scene.
Oshri, what do you think about independence here? I have a feeling that you said you're independent, you want to be independent when you're 14. If you're on the scooter and saying, listen, I'm dependent only on myself. So if I'm already anxious about what's going to happen next year and maybe I'll get a different job and whatever, you're not hugging the experience right now. And as an independent person, you're saying, listen, you know what? No one's going to save me. No one's going to give this promotion. I'm just going to do this the best that I can. Like, what do you say about that? There's something independent about you, maybe being far from home.
Yeah. I think that back in the days, it was a totally different thought. Being an independent person, it's something that I'm still exploring. Now, specifically, I'm exploring, you know, how to see myself, how to ignite myself, how to focus on the right things. It's not like when you are in a big you know, company or whatever, and so you know you sit in a certain platform and you know exactly where to go, you know exactly how your day will look like most of the time. Back in the days, I think that maybe I was lucky that these thoughts came to my head and I decided to change. Actually, I did it twice in my life. I did it when I was the general manager of the Herod's Palace, the Herod's complex in Eilat. It was the biggest position I took as a GM. And almost the same thing happened to me. Always it comes from a crisis. And, you know, we can talk about that as well, how you build yourself from a crisis. Because, you know, as we know, those are the things that will make you stronger. So I think that I was lucky enough to empower myself from this crisis, because it is a crisis. It's not it's a quiet crisis, you know. Being for the third year doing the same thing, it's like people that are married, okay? You know, don't hate themselves, but they are together for 20 years. Nothing new is happening. It's a crisis.
And you're saying that you discovered the magic of real leadership, that stemmed out of this crisis. Seems like you were able to connect on a deeper level, and through that, truly, you know, also ignite. Maybe you sort of understood where the weakness could be in working in a job that can be so so repetitive, and you were able to show your team the magic that you realized yourself. And that seems like something that could be, you know, that could go beyond hospitality to any industry, because at the end of the day, you know, day to day can be pretty mundane. And it seems, you know, that you understood something about leadership and about and about empowering teams. Like, can you talk about that a bit more?
Yeah, first of all, I think about that some of it is technicalities as well. I will tell you why. You know, in those big corporates, every year they are pinpointing the headlines of this year. This year will be the year of. This year will be the year of. I think that the Chinese started that. The year of the chicken, the year of the snake. Yeah. So I think it's technicalities as well, because you need to know, you need to be focused on your goals. The goals should move always. Okay. According to the year, according to the expectations of your bosses, according to your expectations, according to the strength points that you see in your teams, or the weakness points that you see in your teams, and you have to take a decision. And this part is, you know, as I was saying, part of it is your character, of course. And it's always good to bring, I saw many good leaders with huge character stepping in and failing like crazy. And in the other hand, I saw people with lots of knowledge that they gained throughout the years, and they didn't brought their personality, so, and then they failed as well. So I think it's a combination between those two things. You need to bring yourself to the table. You need to bring your personality. You need to bring your soul. You need to be connected to your teams, especially if you have a team. And in the other hand, you need to have the knowledge, because if you don't have the knowledge, people know it immediately. And this is, you know, they don't believe you anymore.
How do you bring your character? Because I'm jumping forward for a second. You're a GM, okay? But then I'm jumping forward to being a CEO of a global hospitality company in three different countries, okay? With, I don't know, 40 different hotels, thousands of people that work for you. So that Oshri charisma, okay, bringing yourself to the table, you can't bring yourself to the table. You can't be with every barman, right? Like, on that step, like, what is the biggest difference between managing that now, different countries? Do you feel like the when you evolved as a leader, what was the difference in leadership there?
I think that your leadership reflects in everything that you do. Everything. People see you everywhere you go. Your teams, they see you. They see everything that you do. You think that they don't. Even if you sit in a table with someone in a meeting, okay? Everyone are looking at you. You are producing stories about you everywhere in your organization. It's an amazing thing. You know, after living as a GM, after, you know, being in a position of a GM for 5 years and then living and then sitting with your team half a year later and hearing the stories that they have about you, it's crazy. So your personality reflects actually in everything that you do. And there are small gestures that you can do that can reflect a lot about you. Just, you know, asking people, saying good morning to people, saying good morning, going, stepping into a dining room to take your coffee. You don't want to speak with anyone. It's been a very long day yesterday. You just need your coffee now. And a huge chain of meetings are waiting for you outside. You just need to take your coffee, but you need to say good morning to everyone. You need to say it with a smile. And if someone told you last week that they went to a vacation, blah, 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 with the kids, you need to ask them how it was. You need to remember stuff. You need to be human with you. And people remember that. You can't imagine how much. I have so many examples for that.
I believe that it's a hospitality sort of mindset that is really embedded within leadership. So it's not just for the guest.
I have a very good story, a very good example for that, because just to show you that it's not only in your character, it's something that you can learn as well. When I was working at the Meridian Hotel, I was a lobby manager, and the dining room manager was my best friend. Actually, we started as a huge, huge competitors. We both of us were shift leaders in the dining room. And then we had a huge fight. After a few days, it was my birthday, the 10th of October. It's a very special date, 10-10-80. And then we discovered, me and this guy, that we are celebrating the birthday together. Anyway, we became best friends. He got promoted to be the dining room manager. I got promoted to be the lobby manager. I was the lobby manager for half a year. He left the company. He left the hotel. And I stepped into the dining room to replace him. After I replaced him, you know, he had a very stable team. It's a very hard job working in the dining room. People started leaving me. one after the other. And you know, in Eilat, usually they live as groups. Those three friends from this city, they go back home. Those two friends, one of them is leaving, so the other is following. And it was crazy. I almost collapsed. It was a very hard thing. You are totally dependent on your team when you are a dining room manager. I took one of the waiter that told me that she wanted to leave, and I told her, look, tell me why everyone are leaving. Why you want to leave? Many people were leaving. She told me, man, you don't even say good morning when you come. When you come to work with us, you don't even say good morning. Everything for you is let's work harder, let's work faster, and everything. I totally forgot the human element. And I learned so many things from this small talk that I had with this girl. And I said to myself, she's right. She's right. Where is the human element? I work with people. This guy that I was replacing was such a funny guy. He was telling jokes with everyone. He took everyone out. He took them to the beach. He was doing stuff with them. And I was so concentrated on the success of this dining room. And I didn't know that this success can be projected only through my team. But I was investing zero to the team back in the days. I was very young and in my first managerial position, real managerial position, but I learned a lot from this story, and I changed a lot through that.
Was it stress before?
Yeah, it was.
I'm asking this because it seems that you're very that you're very kind and that you're very nice. So I'm wondering what would lead a person, to not even say good morning when you certainly seem like I'll say it this way: if it was a guest that entered the dining room, I'm sure that you would remember to say hello.
Of course, of course, of course. 100%. It's again where you put your focus on, okay? Being a dining room manager is a very small position, actually, but you need to feed 600 up to 1,000 people per meal, okay? You have one shot. You have 3 hours. You need to do it successfully. So you have to be super concentrated with everything that you do. Every decision that you take will affect the service in a very strong way. So I was so concentrated on taking the right decisions, and I totally forgot my team. And that's why I'm telling you, in the end, it's a combination between who I came as, the one that was super focused on his goals, on his tasks and everything. But in the other hand, you need to remember the human element, bringing your character. People want to know you. People want to work for you. People need a leader.
I always have this thought, you know, it's the same like in high tech. Like there's so much investment in the human resource and all these perks. And, you know, they try to keep them. And there's this criticism that it's actually a golden cage. And I'm always... Yeah. Skeptical if people really care about the people or if it's just being selfish. You know, at the end of the day, you had to be nice or they would leave you, you know? So, you know, but then again, people can sense when a person isn't being genuine.
You are entering now to a big philosophical question. Yes, maybe, you know, in the end, we are all selfish. Maybe in the end we are all selfish, but you know, as a human being, even as a manager, you want to feel good with what you do. You want to feel that you have a purpose. You want to feel that people are working for you and not with you. And you know, you cannot invest in your team with this thought that if you will do this investment, people will feel grateful and they will feel, because I don't see people in the high-tech industry, going home and feeling grateful about the beautiful schnitzel that they ate for lunch. This is not how you buy people. I think you have to, you know, in Greece, I learned a very nice word that's called meraki. Meraki is this mensch that we say, the Ashkenazi says, you know, being a mensch. Being a manly kind of guy that people appreciate a lot, you know, a person that have his word, you know, if he says something, for sure, he will fulfill. He will never, never throw you. He will never disappoint you. So I think that that this is the part of your character that you have to bring to the table, if you have it, of course. And I don't think that you buy people with a nice meal or having a pool table for the lunch break, because they don't use it, actually. They want to be seen. They want to be a part of something. People want to have a leader. Okay? This is exactly how we feel in our country. I don't want to enter a political discussion, but in the end, both parties, let's say if we have two parties, apparently we have 20 parties, but both parties or all the people, they want to feel that they can rely on a leader, on a leadership.
At the end of the day, it's not a very philosophical question, because at the end of the day, it's very basic psychology. There's a relationship between wanting a leader and knowing that the leader sees your mutual interest. Okay, and the idea is, at the end of the day, that he has a say, but they know what direction they're going at. And it's a mutual relationship. It doesn't have to be caring. It's not a caring situation. Okay, the idea is they're going forward in the direction mutually. Okay, and so no one likes to be led without being seen. That works. You know, there's few very pretentious, scary leaders in life that for a short Saddam Hussein style, short amount of time, they can lead like that. At the end of the day, there's a relationship between being heard, because everybody wants to be seen and heard, okay? And as a team going in the right direction and having someone strong pulling them. That's why most of the best CEOs in the world are actually focused on culture and not on efficiency on that sense. But on that sense, so something's fun about the transition. So as a person born in the 80s, being in hotels, okay? And Noah talked about high tech. So let's talk about that change. Today, how do you market hospitality worldwide? Like, how does that work? How do you bring people to the hotels?
First of all, I learned that the best marketing and public relations that you can do to yourself is just providing a very good service. Because the rumor flies so fast if it's bad or if it's good. And one of the key things is just projecting from the hotel outside the rumor or the news that you have something good in your hand. Of course, we are using all the channels, all the normal channels that we know, OTAs, online travel agencies, booking.com, Expedia, and the rest of them, the big wholesalers. And we are doing, let's divide between marketing activities to sales activities, because marketing activities is a thing that we do to attract the audience. So still, we are publishing and doing some, you know, commercials.
Yeah, but how did like booking and all of that like shake the turmoil? Like if you have no booking now, do you have people?
Yeah, you have people, but it's a different kind of people, and it's a different kind of marketing, because back in the days before booking.com, there was a wholesaler somewhere that was, were publishing an ad on the newspaper, in the local newspaper of I don't know where in England. Says, you know, go for your holiday vacation. And he was posting a beautiful photo of a resort in Thailand, but he was selling Greece. And, you know, you bought it. It was kind of a gambling, 70-30%, okay, that you will do it or not. You would pay the money. You will go. Probably you would be disappointed or not. Depend how much you drank during your vacation. But things have changed completely. Because everything now is crystal clear. Everything is, we are exposed 100% with those platforms, booking.com, Expedia, etc. Airbnb, if you work with Airbnb, you are totally exposed. People see what other people felt. Okay, you can't lie anymore. And people were lying a lot. Okay, you cannot lie anymore. You have to put the right photos. You cannot change the photos. Everything is crystal clear. And I think that it helped a lot to this industry to make it much better. there are no, okay, there are almost not any more tourist traps like they were before.
But now, actually, so you're talking about like reviews and everything. So everybody reviews you, right? So like, how do you manage that? Okay, let's say you have a reviews on hospitality. How would you manage the change of mind of, like, let's say there's hotels that you managed. You had 40 hotels to manage, okay? You see that a few of them are lacking, you know, in the reviews, okay? What would be a change in leadership there?
Look, it's very simple. The platform allows you to understand immediately what people think about you and where you need to improve yourself. So in a click of a button, you see the diagram that show you that your internet is bad, your cleanliness is bad, your service is nice, and the rest of the stuff. The food is great or whatever. And then you know where to focus yourself on. Okay? So the review actually help you to grow. If you know how to read them. Of course, there are people that they still, many times I'm entering a project and I see that people, you know, with a lot of knowledge, good hoteliers who worked in this industry for years, and they don't know how to read it yet because they belong to the, as you said, the old generation. They don't know how to analyze those things. And with lack of abilities to analyze, you cannot grow. So they left behind. And then, usually a big international chain will buy them and will implement this new knowledge that we see around.
I'll tell you what I like about what you're saying, because I think it's coming across your mindset from ever since we started this conversation. That you are always looking for the opportunity. So where somebody will see criticism, you will see constructive feedback, and you're, It seems as almost, and I'm saying it in the best way, as if you almost didn't understand the question, quote unquote, because you were hearing Ronan describe a visualization of where you need to improve. So I think that type of mindset is really helping you. You know, Ronan was asking you earlier in the conversation, why you and why they choose you and how at such a young age you were able to, you know, to climb up and become a manager. And I would say that this is the answer. I think it's the way you're screening the information and selecting how to think that is enabling you to really put yourself on steroids.
Yeah, I think it's a... I think this is my mindset. I don't see things in different in the other way. I see it only that way. I see that behind every difficulty, there is a very big opportunity, probably. And you just need to know how to find it. And in this case, it was very clear to me. I remember, actually, you know, I'm so old now with my gray hair, to tell you that I remember the first HOD meeting that we had, and the GM stepped in to this meeting with a paper in his hand, and he told us, guys, you can't imagine what happened today. We got the first online reservation from booking.com. And it was a celebration. Who knew what a monster will grow from that? Okay? And you know what was funny? It came with a fax, with a fax machine. It didn't came online to the channels directly to the booking system and everything. No, it came from a fax machine. And then we had to implement this reservation to be live. It was so funny. Now, back in the days, when I'm thinking about it, you know, I was doing hundreds of lectures about booking.com. The first thing that I was always discussing is, guys, just first of all, know it. Know the platform. Know how to analyze the platform. People don't know how booking.com algorithm is working and how important it is, because many people will maybe not go with a reservation through booking.com. But definitely they will check your score on booking.com.
You know what, Oshri? I have a question for you. What's the future of hospitality? How's it going to look in 10 years?
I think it will be much clearer to the guests. We see many beautiful products. This is a different approach to your question. I think that the products are getting sharper and sharper throughout the years, not only with the visibility, with the services that people are that people need and the hotel will provide. I see that it's changing. I see a very big movement from the big hotels to the small hotels. Not only boutique hotels, but boutique kind of service.
Like niche hotels?
Part of it is a niche hotel as well. But being exposed to a niche hotel, this is something that we see a lot on the last years. But to be honest, I see mainly that this industry is suffering from a huge crisis, from a human resources crisis. I think that social media changed the mindset of people, and people don't see themselves giving services. They see themselves taking services, because, you know, you go on Instagram or Facebook and you only see people, you know, lying in the beach, drinking cocktails, going to parties, eating nice meals, etc. So you don't have this mindset of, I will do it. I will serve people. I will go work in this industry. You see yourself as a client more.
You mean there's a crisis on people giving services worldwide, meaning it's not a job that people want anymore. The prestige of it.
Exactly. You know, when I came to Eilat, it took me 3 weeks to find a job, and I had a lot of experience. When I came to Greece, and I came as a CEO, you know, so with the first hotel, we published an ad that we need front desk agents, people that will work on the reception. And I received 200 CVs. Okay. 3 years later, I'm publishing the same ad. I'm receiving zero CVs. And this is Greece. Okay. The economy in Greece is not in a great condition. It's growing, but it's not in a great condition. So I think that, that this is the main crisis that this industry will face. And it's related to the culture, to the new generation, to social media. It's related to so many elements. And this is the biggest challenge. This is the next challenge of managers. How to collect a team, how to recruit people. You have to recruit people with a different approach. You cannot do it like we did it in the old days. You cannot treat people like we treated people in the old days. I think everything has changed now, and you need to use different approach.
Probably, by the way, just intuitively thinking, maybe the answer lies in you know, how you as a 14-year-old were happy that you just have pockets full of money and you thought it was cool. So probably, you know, rebranding that and showing that side and actually showing how that leads to the good life potentially could maybe help all those who are, you know, stuck at looking at other people's highlight reels, drinking a cocktail on the beach and refusing such jobs.
That is a good point. Social media is a very good point.
I have a very good idea for that. I think that people in the hospitality industry, employees in the hospitality industry, should move freely around the world because they work in the hospitality industry. And then this creates a huge opportunity to people to discover new cultures, to travel, blah, 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 blah. Like people, I see it a lot in the seasonality industry, you know, in the resorts in Greece when we work seasonality. So you see people that they are traveling. So they work for the whole summer and they travel for the whole winter. Or in the other hand, when I go to ski vacations with my friends and I'm asking, you know, people from the hotel, what do they do? They work for 4 months. That's it. So many of them will go to work in a different place in the summer. So I think that for Europe, they have the answer because they can move freely around Europe with a European passport and they can work wherever they want. So I think that this has to be the answer. Otherwise, we will not see anymore those 70 years old waiter who worked as a waiter for 50 years. We will not see it anymore.
Yeah, I was thinking about that exactly. That it seems also, you know, that in other countries, I think it sort of is a very respected job. And maybe that's something that has to be brought back.
Yeah. Look, even in you know, weaker countries, like even, you know, in Thailand or whatever, you know, those kind of places that the economy is not amazing, you see that they are struggling as well with finding the right teams. They're struggling to, yeah, you speak with a waiter and he's from India. You speak with a waiter, he's from the Philippines. He's not from Thailand. And so if the only way to create it is to create this mixture of people having the ability to move around, to work in the hospitality industry. And I think that our government for sure would have, in Israel, would have to give us a great solution for that. And this solution comes only as recruiting people from abroad.
Oshi, tell me, what's your superpower?
I think I answered that already. I think that consistency is my superpower, and I think I would give three edges to my superpower. One is my consistency, my ability to move forward again and again and again. The second one is to always be in a learning process, always. Not being, sleeping, not evolving, always learning about stuff, reading, podcasts, whatever needed to build yourself more and more. And maybe the third part of it will be my courage to step in and to take on myself difficult stuff, difficult things. Being courageous is a very important thing in life.
What would be your weakness?
My weakness? Oh, I feel like I'm in a job interview. What is my biggest weakness? Maybe I can take things sometimes more personal than they are. Because I feel that in the end, everything is personal. So I give word a lot of weight, you know, and sometimes, you know, your manager just said something. He didn't meant that it's the end, or, you know, one of my managers once told me, you know, he said something to me and said, you know, you have to improve yourself in this and that, blah, blah, blah. And I was sad for a week. And then he came to me and he saw that. And he came to me and he hugged me and he said, you know that I love you. The fact that I said something once doesn't mean that you're not good. Come on, step out of it. And I think that this is maybe one of my weaknesses.
It sounds like a weakness and a superpower, which is many times the case. But, you know, it sounds like, your weakness is you're human.
Yeah, we all are.
Oshri, I think I speak for both of us when I say that we wish you to keep looking at the bright side and to keep pushing forward and to try to truly do good in the world and make people feel good and empowering people throughout your journey.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
And thanks for the lesson of remembering to being human, no matter how big the company is. The human component is also the most important one. So thanks, Oshri, for your time.
It's the only way that people will remember you. They will remember only the human element that you brought to the table.
Yeah, there's a saying, people will not remember what you said, they'll remember how you made them feel.
Exactly. 100%.
Amazing. Keep safe and thanks for your time, Oshri.
Guys, you make me feel good. Bye.
That's all for today's episode. We hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please consider subscribing to our podcast so you never miss an episode. Also, if you have a moment, we would really appreciate it if you could rate and review our podcast on the platform you're listening to. This will help others find our show. And as always, if you know anyone who you think would enjoy our podcast, please share it with them. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back as usual on the first of the month.
Real. Live.
Superpowers.
Live.
Superpowers.